So our next speaker is David Holm. He's currently director of trade and markets, the trade markets division at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. Always sounds appealing, right? He got his training at the universities of Oxford and Reading. When he was at Reading, he worked on analysis of agricultural commodity markets and policy. Was also director of the Center of Agricultural Strategy at the university. He's written numerous books and articles on agricultural commodity markets, trade, and development, and has served as the editor of the Journal of Agricultural Economics. So, ladies and gentlemen, David Holm.
Thank you, John, and good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk about two interrelated subjects. First is foreign direct investment in developing country agriculture, and the second is the development of what are called the Principles for Responsible Agricultural Investment. This is an initiative on the part of FAO, the World Bank, IFAD, and UNCTAD. So you might ask, well, why are we talking about these subjects in a session that's on food security and risks to food security? Well, the answer to that question is that the recent trends in foreign direct investment in developing country agriculture are focused very much on large-scale land acquisitions and carry with them rather important food security implications. Now, I prepared quite a lot of slides. I'm not going to go through them all, but I hope they'll be made available to you to give more detail on these themes. And also, there's a recent article in the Journal of Food Security which covers the whole story for those of you who are interested. A couple of years ago in Rome, we organized a conference called Feeding the World in 2050. And what that conference, or some of the background analysis for that conference came up with, was that if we are actually going to feed the world in 2050, then year by year we need a net addition to investment in agriculture of about $83 billion. That's net. Now the question is, well, where is that going to come from? And if you look at how for example, official development assistance has gone in recent years. At one point, the share going to agriculture had fallen to less than 5%. Commercial banks, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, less than 10% of their lending goes to agriculture. Developing country governments are strapped for resources. Again, spending on agriculture and agricultural investment has become very limited. So there's an interesting question. Is there a role here, then, for foreign direct investment? And it's interesting to note that, on the one hand, you have, at the moment, a great apparent willingness on the part of foreign investors to invest in developing country agriculture and land. And you've got a great wish on the part of many developing countries to attract that investment. Now, there are risks involved, and I'll talk about those in a moment. And as a result of those risks, then what we've seen is a great deal of media coverage which has highlighted those. And so on the slide, there's some examples. I probably give at least two media interviews a week on this subject. And it's not slowing down. The interest is there. And the reason why all that concern is there is because of what looks like a pretty anomalous situation where you've got countries like Ethiopia, which is food insecure, a least developed country, opening its doors to foreign investors to take over the operation of scarce land resources. So clearly, this looks a little bit anonymous. Now, because of the risks that are involved, this is what prompted the four organizations that I've mentioned to come together and to prepare a kind of international response to try and guard against some of the risks that might happen. And more recently, the G20 in its Seoul summit reinforced the request to those four organizations to continue their work in this area and to look for ways to encourage responsible investment. It is controversial, though, this work, and a group of NGOs came up last year with what's called the Dakar Appeal. There's an effort to try to limit the amount of investment. And so they called, this is particularly FIAN and Via Campesina and so on, and they called for a moratorium on this kind of investment. And they called our hard-worked principles to govern it illegitimate and inadequate. So we'll come back to that issue later. Okay, so what do we know about this investment? We've, in all the organizations involved, but particularly the World Bank and FAO, have been involved in doing a lot of research on just what is going on, what is the extent of these investments, and what are the pros and cons of them. Of course, foreign investment in developing countries and culture is not a new phenomenon. The amount of hard information we have about what's actually going on is quite limited. And most of the new investment, which has increased since the 2007-08 World Food Crisis, has been very much emphasizing large-scale land acquisitions, the so-called land grab. It's difficult to get an idea of the scale of what we're talking about here. A recent Oxfam report claimed that we were looking at 200 million hectares of land that had changed hands. Actually, only about half of that is corroborated. This is all largely based on media and interviews and so on. Not the ones given by myself. But about half of that is corroborated, and maybe half of that is actually foreign investment. And what we found in our research is that much of what is being branded as being kind of rapacious foreign investment is actually domestic investment, domestic political elites and so on, rather than foreign. The investors, it's all kinds of people. It's agribusiness, it's banks, it's institutional investors, some sovereign wealth funds, but not much. On the other side, the investment deals, it's national governments. And I'll come back to the issues there. What's interesting, as I mentioned, is that these investments are emphasizing the acquisition of productive resources. So in that sense, they're resource-seeking rather than market-seeking investments, which have been the predominant form of foreign direct investment in recent years. So why is it happening? Well, on the part of investors, I've listed on the left-hand side why it's happening. The main investors are countries like the Gulf states and so on, which have got pretty serious resource constraints. And so they're looking to secure their future food security by investing and producing overseas and bringing back the product to consumer home. A lot of investors are in pursuit of biofuel production. Some of them are just out for portfolio diversification and financial gain. But why are developing countries welcoming these investments? Well, they're welcoming them partly because of the need for investment, which I've mentioned earlier, but also because they see developmental benefits from these kind of investments, the idea being that FDI brings in technological improvements and so on. And you often see them, especially in Africa, referring to the need to exploit surplus land. Well, all of you who've done any work in Africa or visited Africa will know that that's a highly questionable concept. perhaps a lot of land is not used to its greatest productive potential, but the idea that it's complete surplus is a difficult one to deal with. So what are the impacts? We've done, as have the bank, a lot of detailed case studies. We've now covered about 16 highly detailed studies. The bank recently published a report which covered about 40. And a priori, the benefits of foreign investment coming in are things like technology transfer and upgrading, creation of employment and through multiplier effects and linkages into domestic economy, those kind of things. The negative side, though, is what is the impact on food security? What is the impact on smallholder agriculture and other local stakeholders? There are questions about transparency, governance issues, and also about environmental issues. So, what our case studies show is that a lot of those doubts and questions are pretty well founded. So we have found instances where the majority of these kind of contracts lack transparency, limited consultation with local stakeholders, displacement without compensation, and environmental damage as well. So there is a case then, a strong case, for trying to look closely at these investments and maybe come up with some ideas of how to regulate them, if you like, or to at least guide them to avoid some of these adverse consequences. And that's where the Rye principles come in. So on the one hand, we've got a case where we're desperately needing investment. We've got foreign investors willing to fund those kinds of investments, but there are risks attached to it. So the basic question is, how can we steer those investments into productive uses for the benefit of all stakeholders? And so that's where the idea for international guidelines comes in. And the sort of things that those guidelines need to emphasize are the need for transparency, good governance accountability, provision for food security, provision for addressing other stakeholder interests. And the idea is that these guidelines, as it says in the final bullet here, are aimed to provide a framework for national regulations, international investment agreements, and global corporate social responsibilities. So, we came up with a list of 7 principles, and they're listed here. There's more detail given in the presentation, in the slides, which you can look at later. But as you see, these 7 principles highlight all of those risk areas. Just to say something about the nature of them, we're talking about voluntary principles here, not some kind of international regulatory. We don't feel there is any political will towards anything other than voluntary standards. They're based on detailed research that we and the bank especially have been involved in. They're based on existing international commitments, voluntary guidelines on land tenure, which FAO is developing, on the basic human right to food, the Equator Principles, OECD guidelines on multinational enterprise, and so on. And we're working through extensive consultations with all stakeholders in further developing these principles. As I mentioned, the G20 adopted these at the SAIL summit. And so what do we do next? Well, as I said, we're still working on these principles. We're developing them, annotating them. We're continuing our research. We're continuing consultations. The especially through the Committee on World Food Security. But we're also piloting and testing the principles with governments and with the private sector. So just to finish, to return to the question, is all our hard work illegitimate and inadequate? I don't think it's illegitimate for the reason being that basically they simply bring together existing international commitments, have the support of the G20 and the four organizations. Are they inadequate? Well, they're voluntary, they're not legally binding, so in that sense you could say yes, it's not as strong a set of regulations as would be appropriate. But just to mention that already we're seeing that this work is having an impact. And it's interesting that one of the things that we're doing is this awful term, retrofitting. So we're, through our case studies, we're looking back at actual investments to see how they measure up to the principles. It's interesting to note that if these principles have been used as the guidelines, almost all of the serious abuses that we've seen would never have happened. So stop.